So welcome everybody to the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series. Before we get started, a few reminders. Please don't smoke. Please silence your cell phones. And if you can refrain from getting up during the reading, that would be helpful. Our first reading is a poetry reading. And if you could, refrain from clapping until the end. So I'm going to introduce our first reader. His name is Matt Wenzel. He's a first-year PhD student in creative writing, specifically poetry at Florida State. His work has appeared in Puerto del Sol, Glitter Wolf Magazine, Guide to Culture Creative Journal, Right Hand Pointing, Off the Rocks Anthology, Glass, a Journal of Poetry, among others. He is a recent MFA graduate from Ashland University and a 2015 Lambda Literary Fellow. And he currently has 34 stamps in his national parks passport. So Matt's official bio doesn't say that he attended Bible school, a real school only about the Bible, that he holds a master's in education, that he ran for Utah State Senate in 2014, and that he taught high school for 10 years. Everything Matt's done is capital G good work. But there's something to his various and expansive background that helps me understand the moral compass tattooed invisibly under his toned physique. I had a writing teacher who was a poet who used to lecture my undergraduate class repeatedly on how we were going to have to stop flinching when we got to the parts of our short stories that were difficult to write. In Matt's poetry, as in his life, he doesn't bother with the parts that are easy. The content of his poems will speak for itself, but on the page, the poetry reaches another level in its use of formal techniques like the abecedarian form and the shape of a perfect square. Within the lines, his poems drive as if through mountain roads, shifting registers to powerfully mirror the dissonance between our inside worlds and our outer bodily ones. A reviewer recently wrote in Stay Thirsty magazine that in Matt's poems, the body is enough, and that the sacred is never too far away. While these are expert artifacts of language in themselves, Matt's poems are also manifestations of his unspoken love language, gift giving. In the short 8 months that I have known him, Matt has bestowed on me a number of gifts that listed together seem decadent. They have included one miniature bottle of real maple syrup from his home state of New Hampshire, tarot readings, a wolf's nail, a birthday crock pot of cheesy sausage dip, a tarot deck, a crystal, four or more, now five, individual tarot cards drawn for luck on various monumental occasions, beers, donut holes, an iced coffee, a tiny box of Russell Stovers, and a partridge feather. There's a fundamental knowledge behind Matt's generosity that he has something to give every person. Please join me in accepting this poetic communion.
Oh my God, thank you, Whitney, for making me want to cry before I even start reading. Thanks, everyone, for coming. And I also want to say thank you to Keith Kopka. He's actually not here tonight, but he does everything when it comes to the warehouse, except stand on this stage. So I do want to thank him, and hopefully he listens to this recording. I'm going to start with a poem called No Man is an Island Except St. John of Patmos. It's like reading Oscar Wilde and suddenly the Salome cutout of your sexually developmental years strips off her seven veils and you're using an X-Acto knife to remove the head from John the Baptist. If I feel guilty about flushing Buster, the baby hamster, down the toilet, what do I call the feeling that I've left my Sunday school teacher a ransom note for her Bible cut from the letters in her Bible? If Egyptians and pagan Hebrews shaved off their eyebrows when their cats died, what should I do to show that I am hashtag sorry, not sorry? The Facebook headline is this, Matt's gay, The cyber caption reads, "I'm shocked, hashtag said no one ever. My life history is cached, downloadable from my focus on the family boss. To the old ladies my mother made tea and scones with lashings of jam and soggy sarnies for. I still wake up with the hymns in my radio head. I'm standing on the promises that one day I will be sorry. Toss another on the fire, throw in some fuzzy-backed Bible characters, demerit slips, drop in gasoline-annotated scriptures. If A equals my bicycle on your front lawn and C equals love, then B, can't you just for 1 second look up at me, even through your cheap plastic lenses? I'm sorry I called them cheap." So like Whitney said, I went to Bible school for 2 years, where I, yes, only studied the Bible. And so this is a poem that I wrote about Bible school, and it's called Sticks. And this is a new one. That one was an old one. "I forgot until this morning that I once lived in a tree-tall valley by a lake, forgot the mist from my shared chalet, forgot the pool one can become, held by rock body all around, a stronger material than we human animals are made of. There too, the sky kneeled before the bulk of the mountain, ragged-edged, and their permanent rendezvous was reflected on the mirrored ceiling of the lake, like a black-and-white postcard, the smutty one at the back of the white wire carousel. I'm sure birds sang, though they be East Coast birds where I lived, and at least one banged his beak against a tree over and over for the creamy filling of beetles or insight beyond this mousetrap dome where trotting on a blade of grass could set in motion the demise of some sweet or terrible species. But in my village, the morning quiet was penetrated by deep blue-violet voices of men singing hymns, bare and barrel-chested, trimming their beards, youth smooth, and prayer and fasting thin, spitting in the sink, or rich with muscle, as the mountains had muscle, nude, as they are also nude, in the shower singing, we have an anchor that keeps the soul steadfast and sure, while the billows roll, fastened to the rock, which cannot move, grounded firm and deep in the Savior's love. All day the singing burned in my ears and circulated to my extremities so that the crunch of my leather shoes on the rocky paths was drowned by its throbbing, so that when I shook my brother's hands, I'm sure the heat of it transferred, and so that it warmed me as I turned the onion pages of my scriptures, and as I sweated out my work duties, up until the very moment our summer night meeting would begin. Here, on the shore of the lake, pooling so still, I cannot tell you how still, the men had built a 20-foot pile of cordwood and sticks. I faded grave cold as the faithful lit diesel-soaked rags and tossed them high in the air, arcing toward the saturated pile, while others stoked it with more bundles of sticks. And inevitably, grinning from ear to ear, one of these Christian soldiers would joke, it's time to throw another fag on the fire. So when I was at Bible school, and I'm going to get off the Bible school thing, I swear, we all had to go on like a mission trip thing kind of every term. And the one that I was doing was somewhere else in upstate New York, and some people had gone there and come back. And these girls would always come back and they'd say, Matt, we've met this kid, this place, and he's just like you. And I thought, okay. And they're like, you should be his pen pal. They told me that I should be his pen pal. And I actually had lots of pen pals. That's kind of the writing that I did when I was young. I wrote a lot of letters. And so I started being his pen pal. Well, of course, like it turned out that we were both gay, but they didn't have the language to say that. So that's what we had in common. And this is a letter to him, and his name is like sort of weirdly hidden in this poem. So I should probably just call it by his name, but I've used his initial instead. So you can look for a word that starts with D. That's also a name. It's called Dear D. I read your letters like literature, like the books in the Bible school library with blank checkout cards, my finger on the crease of the envelope, tearing it open, thickened my blood, like the first time I clicked on an ad for gay porn in the Bible school computer lab, when I opened the slender bronze door of my mailbox, 1,000 nerve endings opened the mythology that are twin handwriting, twin mannerisms, the kind Bible school girls didn't have a name for, could make us something I dared not name. I couldn't have known we'd meet with beards, or that you'd chase my bus down the street in your tailored pants, or that you'd drive me around Kentucky in your truck, or that you, my monastery window, my dusty field guide, might hear aloud the secret we both knew, we both knew. This one's called Dear L. How can I tell you so that you'll understand? Remember how dirty the kitchen window could get, the one in the house downtown? Remember the pear tree outside the window and its terrifying season, stickly branches pricking the gray sky, virginally green buds and know-it-all white blossoms, dangling fruit so Edenic, it's demonic. Then a brief and beautiful descent into death. It's like that, my love, like taking off my kitchen window tortoise shell frames, having them wiped perfectly clean, and putting them back on my face. It's like that tree, the one that keeps stumbling back to life. Okay, and I'm gonna read one more letter poem. Just kidding, I'm gonna read more later, but this is the last one for now. And this one's called Dear B. And this one you can laugh, it's kind of funny. It's supposed to be funny. In the way that we know a poem through its greening lines, and in turn know the poet through the leaves of his pages, I know you. If I held your hand, I could hear the chatter, the footsteps, the prayer of the pilgrims at Dolorosa you forgot because you were taking so many digital pictures. The soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him. There's a tree in California that's been growing for 800 years. There's space between every atom. I was so ashamed of my recuperating toenail, I wrapped it with a paper bandage for 18 months. If our dating profiles matched, so would our Emily Dickinson quotes, our palms, our taste for honey, and our postures of repose. There's a website for guys who are into armpits. Our father has asked for the death of many sons. There are cattle grazing in the mountains on clover and sandwiches. There are beaches where clothing is optional. The sun has never repented. The koa tree feeds caterpillars its fruit, butterflies its sap, and shield bugs the essence of its seed. I could Facebook stalk you in my army green trunks all morning. I could swim in the clear and potable water of the caldera in the cusp of the mountain. Okay, so this next one, well, in case you haven't got it, I kind of write confessional poetry. This next one is like one of my most confessional ones, and most of it's true, which I'm sort of ashamed of. But I'm not ashamed of confessional poetry, I don't think. One of the oldest ways that the word confess was used was for people who felt really strongly about their religion that they were willing to be persecuted or die for it. So in that sense, I'm glad that my poetry is confessional. Also, I'm slightly embarrassed that I was so cruel to animals, but oh well, here we go. It's called Restless. My ear to his chest, like to a shell, I hear the cataracts of the sea, smell the rain-dipped wet of my childhood garden, where I dug up unclothed earthworms to use as bait. I'd carry them in a bucket to their impalement, but never slid their rubbery bodies on the hook and down the shaft myself. It was the digging up that brought me pleasure. Once, so enamored with a helium balloon, I tied it to my belt loop as I dug for night crawlers. The long handle of my spade cut the string and freed the red balloon to ascend like Icarus toward explosive death. I suppose the pieces returned to Earth to be choked on or swallowed by sea turtles or squirrels mistaking the latex for oak leaves, the string for sinew. I captured 2 houseflies in the plastic shell of my box of crayons, sometimes peeling off a wing or leg and watching it squirm under the transparency of my art supply. His heartbeat is strong and fast, and I can watch only so many minutes flip over on his nightstand alarm clock before I must go. One time, I punched a hole in a quarter and tied it to a string. I let the Coke machine swallow it and pulled it back up. Forget the Coke machine. I don't know how to tell you that I'm an albatross and you are a dark stone. Hand me my underwear, thank you. What I mean to say is that I'm a clutch spinning between gears, and that this song is a song that's playing in an elevator occupied by one, in an office building still under construction, in a state capital plagued by budget amendments and widespread mismanagement. I'm not sorry that I made eye contact as I entered you, nor for my knack of finding all the connections, but I'm in love with the cleaned and pressed sunrise and the joy of pine trees and low ferns, pine trees and student loans, pine trees and a rock resting with an already evaporating cheek stain. Okay, so this next one is an ekphrastic poem, which I'm like really conflicted about writing ekphrastic poetry because it's traditionally like male poets writing about paintings, and the paintings are typically women. But this particular piece of art that I wrote about is William Blake's Job's Evil Dreams. So you can look it up when you get home if you want to, but it's not that exciting really. But so Job is like laying down on this, I don't know, creepy stone table, and there's like demons holding onto him or something. But then Lucifer, Satan or whatever, is like hovering directly above him. And I couldn't help look at that drawing and I suppose like feel some sort of attraction for Satan, which is complicated. But I also felt a lot of empathy for him as well. And so it was like that I wanted to be him and also to possess him, I suppose. So that's what this poem's about. It's called Lucifer Draws Closer. Let's not wake him, because if we do, I think he will remember his nightmare, the one in which his skin warts from the inside, worm orgy on the outside, sips humor of cattle to keep him just alive enough. Enough for his spine to rotten, but still walk if his feet aren't boiling verruca. Enough to hunger a little for crispy pet. Enough for cloudy eyes to swell and saline burn his blackened lips. Enough for him to suck out a curse, mephitic. Enough to hold the curse in his teeming bowels. Hold his legs from thrashing, his body from convulsing. Here, unchain these links. I am bringing all I have to comfort you. Become as human as I can. Formed marble arms to hold you as you wake. Trimmed only invisible light from my hair and beard. hoofed and flown on Rainbow Airlines. I have studied your tablets, have let the electric tingle of chastening cauterize, sailed on vapors of truthfulness, and touched hell's pale tongues. I think this dream will haunt you, but I am here to tell you the distance between illusion and impossible is great, navigable. All right, here's another letter poem. It's called Dear Poet, and it's technically also ekphrastic. It's a painting of Virgil reading the Aeneid to Augustus and these two ladies who are like fainting, Octavia and Livia. Let's not talk about my reaching out toward you. Not that I'm embarrassed, you know that I'm not. I too have waited on the shores, took notes and slotted them. It's just that all of us were fainting at the sight of Dido, living, dolled up, dead, just a doll. Pastor Thrace had traveled far to tell us what we already knew, bridge closed, only the righteous will inherit the kingdom. And I have been especially lonely among all the sighs and soft fainting. This brow comes with certain dignities, certain positions, a certain kind of white now on our wrists, on your scroll and my neck, and cannot hope in your intervention, can mix tears in the gymnasium, but here must wear the finest, must hire mourners, must tend to the lovers, must tend to the tenders, fixed stars, and a very long tradition. When I found out my mother wanted no burial, all this business seemed a joke, crownless, I reached for you, and I'll not take that back. Okay, this next one, I had a little help on the title, so thank you to the person that helped me on this title. It's called Sex and Crucifixion. In a studio apartment, I'm hearing Aramaic for the first time, naked and taking its particularity into my lungs. They say he was suffocating, that for him to breathe, he had to hoist himself up on the spikes, that each breath was a fire, that he was between men of ill consort. My lover smokes, and I draw their knee between my legs. My outstretched arm bends to trace their chest. Perdition, gone up in flames, is now white ash cold. Their tiny hairs stand on end. I thought them hairless. The cross is a purple spectacle. His agony, pornography. My ecstasy now passed from mouth to mouth. Their perfumed fingers draw a figure on my ribs. Each sound I have hidden in my heart. Each word a lamp unto our chilly feet. Our last breaths a cumulus of this short earth and the pleasure of saying goodbye. Okay, I have one more letter. And when I went to go search for this poem title called Unsent Letter, I guess it turns out I have like five poems called Unsent Letter, so I need to like move on and get over this letter writing thing. It's called Unsent Letter, hopefully the last. I want to tell you, I'll not send this letter. Instead, we'll smear the black ink under my arm, opaque curves. You and I are type bars stuck in trying to strike at exactly the same time. How thick you struck, how firm I stood, and took so long to hold my arms above my head in front of him without hope or security. Shudder here, sun bright, creamy fire. You left with him. You forgot to say hello. I heard the bell. I thought to throw myself into the street and instead slammed the return carriage to say, crumpled ball of corners translucent, parch, ink, run, dry, I miss you. Okay, thanks everyone for coming. I have one more poem. And again, I just want to thank you all for coming. And I especially want to thank everybody that's in my first year cohort. I tried to write a poem that used stuff from all of your work, but that ended up being really hard, especially because fiction people don't have a lot of stuff online. So instead, I wrote this cento out of the poems of as many poets as I could find online that are here at Florida State, that are students at Florida State. So if you don't know, a cento is a poem that's made up entirely of the lines of other people's poetry. And so the word cento has like lots of different meanings, I guess. But one of them means to plant slips of trees. And so I've called this cento for trees because I love trees, and also I think I can say I love all of these poets as well. So thank you all for being part of my life. And I guess if you want to know like whose line is whose, you can just ask the poets here which of these lines is their line. But maybe they won't remember. I don't know. So then if you talk to them and they don't know, then you can look at my poem if you want to. Okay, it's called Cento for Trees. For all the fish, the little blessings that I missed, my maraschino yolk, my lover collared gray, do you want me to tuck my tongue inside you and not in boxes? The slow glide over it. Will they find pearls? Will someone whisper miracle? I wash the same bowl of armpit hair, huddled up next to the highway, all thumbs, a stainless steel band of stars on my right hand, as if to say, remember, you are equal to anything equal to the earth. What happened is the thing grew tired as snow, and it is a bridled thing, panicky, slow to trust, an arcade of salvation. His figure was muscled with flame, and I kept silent. I am rarely afraid of a man, but I am often afraid of the highway still caught in our genes. What we swallowed in private, the caverns of your collarbones, his dust towards the motion of us falling when he asks if I like kisses. If all you wanted to know was what sex was, I could have told you, your cum tastes like honeysuckle, and might we be beautiful? I hear the universe is dying, and its death is easy to measure. That still tends to crop up around here to keep what I kept from you. One whistle shriek, and we'd all fall to our knees. Thanks, everyone. So I have the pleasure of introducing our next reader, and my friend at AWP said that I just need to cry more, so I'm going to like embrace that. I think that I'm not going to get through this without doing that, but I'll just read this, I guess. According to me, Whitney, yeah, thank you. According to me, Whitney and I first met here at the warehouse. We were talking zodiac signs. Whitney is a Cancer moon, Scorpio sun, Virgo rising. I'm an Aries moon, Virgo sun, Capricorn rising. Whitney insisted that we were compatible because of her two water signs and my two earth signs. She said, we're going to be friends. I agreed. She said, I'm serious. We're going to be friends. I agreed, and I meant it. I just didn't know exactly what that would mean. According to Whitney, we first met in class when she discovered that I'd been stalking her Instagram account since we both got accepted at Florida State. Yesterday, when I leaned over the cubicle partition in Dodd to confront Whitney with these conflicting stories, she didn't mind at all. "Tell your story as you remember it," she told me calmly, plainly. It's Whitney's ability to stay in the indicative that I'm jealous of and admire greatly. She seems seldom caught in the subjunctive world of what ought to be, and never the imperative of what has to be done. Instead, she's solidly placed herself in the here and now, in what is. Recently, we sat on Whitney's porch with some whiskey and wine to interview each other for details we can include in these intros. Whitney turned on a recorder to tape our conversation, asking me if I thought it would stifle our conversation. I said it wouldn't, though I thought it might. Maybe I asked her a question, maybe she asked me a question, but within a minute or two, the conversation dissolved from interview to Matt and Whitney porch talk. I told her of sadness in my life, which she received like it was some sort of gift. There was no talk of the fact that we should be working on our intros or talk of what we had to do. Instead, we were just two people on a porch. In fact, Whitney never talks shop to me. Throughout the week, she does her warehouse stuff and I do mine. When we talk in Dodd, it's about sexy firemen, religion, family, or boys. Tuesday nights, too, we mostly just drink and talk, not about workshop or class, and only briefly about the itinerary for the night. Though the other night she did say, "I think it's funny that I end up attending to all the little details when you're the Virgo." I think that's kind of funny too. But I'm grateful, Whitney, that you attend to the details that you attend to, because keeping things in order sometimes feels really hard when my world seems to be getting more and more chaotic. Thanks for being okay with that, Whitney. I could never have imagined that we'd end up at Finnegan's Wake with Keith Kopka, getting all the info for hosting the warehouse, that you'd be here with me in one of my darkest hours, that we'd spend every Tuesday hanging out, and that we'd both think it's a great idea if we hosted the warehouse for the whole school year. Whitney has done all kinds of amazing things, like teaching in Mississippi, driving all around the country by herself, and singing and playing guitar with all kinds of people. But she's not really focused on any of that. She's focused on what is right here in front of us. I think you'll see that in her writing tonight, too. This indicative voice that says, she was thin and pale in the arms, and we're going to be friends. With the same matter-of-fact conviction there's just no arguing with. Please join me in welcoming my dear friend and fellow warehouse host, Whitney Gilchrist, to the stage.
So this is a short story. It's called The Delivery. The year that Xander reached the age that his sister, Devin, had been when she killed herself was the same year that he began working as a driver for the mortuary service. Hughes Herring was his parents' next-door neighbor still. He was there to help Xander's mother take care of Devin's body, and 10 years later, he was there to give Xander a job. Xander barely remembered the violence itself, remembered only looking for her, sensing the terror and hiding. He remembered his mother calling his name and admonishing him, "Don't leave this room." He remembered crying, trying to find a hiding place that really was a hiding place. There was the cabinet in the kitchen that he and his sister had called the doghouse, where they crawled, hidden in plain sight, and listened to the sounds of their mother cooking. He remembered when his mother began keeping dishes there again. When he began college, Xander was miserable over the weekend. He didn't like how classes stopped on Friday, didn't like the Saturday, and hated the Sunday, the way that anxiety would grip his chest somewhere between 12 and 3 p.m., make him feel like he'd smoked a pack of unfiltered cigarettes. In the evening, it would leave him starved and empty, like a fever had broken. A few weeks of the Sunday blues into the fall semester of freshman year, he told his mother that he might get a job on the weekends. She suggested he call Hughes. He got the weekend job and began to swim in the mornings. He went to the racquet club lap pool and began his day surrounded by old people, their wrinkled bodies a comfort to him. These elderly bodies were similar to the ones that came through the mortuary, often spotted, with the skin tight in some places and loose in others. It was a day in January, a Saturday, and after swimming, dressing, and driving to the mortuary, Xander walked into the cool, crisp room, and Hughes showed him a boy, 15, African-American, killed with a bullet. The tag did not say the intention of the bullet or who was behind it, but the wound was there on his chest. Hughes had cleaned it and covered him in a sheet. He was finishing the paperwork when Xander walked in. He wrote the time on the tag and checked his clipboard against the folder of papers that would accompany the boy to the funeral parlor like a packing slip. Hughes looked at Xander with his moist eyes through reading glasses. "Long day ahead," he said, nodding toward the two rows of bodies that filled all of the gurneys. His face was dewy, and the pencil shook a bit in his hand. It was only 6 a.m., but Hughes had been there for an hour or more. "We're going to roll this one to the back for now. You're driving him to New Orleans tonight." Xander nodded. He'd been to New Orleans once before with his old girlfriend. He remembered only the littered pedestrian streets, Frenchman, bourbon, the rows of bars whose fronts were wide open, daiquiris and go-cups, her bare feet mixing with trash juice on the cobblestones. "I'm going to Meridian, but I'll let you take the good van," Hughes said. This van had quiet brakes, an accurate gas gauge, a single crack in the windshield. Usually Hughes saved the local trips for Xander, sending him in the other van. They rolled the boy into the cooler back room and returned to the second body in the row. It was an old woman, a grandmother who probably ate while she cooked. The skin of her face sunk away from her bones on either side, toward the gurney, withdrawing gradually from the world. Xander took his place next to her left hip, picked up the tube and held it evenly with her body while Hughes made incisions and let the liquids begin to flow and embalm her. Xander watched the face as though it might change, but they never picked up the vibrations of the living. Her jaw hung open in resignation, and Xander watched her, maybe his 200th body to embalm, and felt a newer thing, a comfort with the dead, who promised not to move and always kept to it. Hughes, with gloved hands, parted the lips and the teeth, stapled into the woman's soft palate, stapled into the place below her tongue, and threaded the two together. He pulled her mouth closed and tied the knot. Xander took scissors and slipped the leftover string just in front of her teeth. In the evening, after they got around the room and loaded the vans, Hughes put the folder of paperwork into the driver's side door and placed a credit card in Xander's hand for gas and sent him down Highway 49 toward a New Orleans funeral home with directions and an address scrawled on printer paper. In the rearview mirror, the Herring Mortuary sign dangled in its frame. As he drove, Xander listened to a forecast for cooling temperatures, then flipped the stations as he breezed through a catalog of small towns. Macomb was the budget inn, an unwritten country song. The town of Petal was an intersection whose lights flashed to warn that someone may be leaving. The next place was unfamiliar, unmarked, and the four-lane highway narrowed to two. The van began to smell like a dissection table beneath the perfume of the pine air freshener. The gas tank was only a quarter full anyway, so he pulled over at the next gas station, intending to buy cigarettes to mask the smell. The marquee above the place read, $2 long neck. Inside looked dark, with shades covering the windows, and the only light a Coors logo. He fueled the van with the mortuary credit card, leaning against the door and listening. Mississippi winter was always damp, breezy, carrying thunderstorms in and out. Xander didn't know any different. He remembered a few snows from his childhood, but this wet chill was the cold he knew best. He pulled a rabbit's foot that he carried from his pocket and fingered the pitch black fur, thought of its deadness like that of the people. It was his sister's, a grotesque totem that he took after she died. The door to the gas station opened, twittering a bell attached to the doorframe. Xander put the rabbit's foot away and stood up straight. A woman stumbled outside, laughing, alone. The gas pump hadn't begun to gurgle, but he let up on the handle and replaced the nozzle and its shelf. He nodded to the woman as he turned back around a screw in the gas cap. "Hey," she said. He looked over at her. "Good evening," he said, waving, unsure. The woman was seated on the stoop in the yellow floodlight, wearing a sleeveless vest covered in pink sequins over a gold tube top that clung to her body like another skin. She fumbled in a purse. "Come have a cigarette with me," she said, waving a pack up above her head. She lit hers. He saw that her face was iced in makeup that was translucent like old-fashioned vanilla cake frosting. She was thin and pale in the arms. "You must be trying to come inside," she said, offering him the cigarettes. "I just stopped for gas," Xander said. "You got lucky. Johnny's getting rid of the pump soon." She watched carefully, leaning towards him as he lit his cigarette. "You're a looker," she said, erupting in girlish laughter. "A looker. Where did I get that?" Xander smoked and watched each car that passed. Every once in a while, he looked at her hands, which were thin and scrappy, like she'd had some experiences. "I'm on drugs," she finally said, sucking on her cigarette. "Sorry." She glanced at his eyes, and they locked for a second, still not searching. She looked down, and he looked back at the highway. "You ought to come inside," she said. "My sister's in a show." Xander smiled. "What's a show?" he said. "Kind of burlesque, kind of our own thing," she smiled. "A cute guy like you don't know nobody can enjoy yourself. My brother's in there. Bunch of guys I grew up with. They just come to look." She paused. "You just get sick of the same losers, even if they do lose weight or change cologne. It's just a band-aid." Xander was feeling peaceful with the nicotine and thinking about asking her for another cigarette for later in the drive. The girl took staccato puffs of hers, slouching. "My ex is in there, too, already ruining my night, and yours, too, technically." After the first, she lit a second cigarette. She scooted back to lean the side of her head against the metal door, pressing her ear to it. "What town are we in?" Xander asked. With her ear still pressed against the door, she scanned his face with her eyes. "We're in Crowder." She paused, grew a smile. "You really just driving through?" "Yes," he said. When she was satisfied that she wasn't missing anything inside, she sat up and darted her eyes at the highway as if she had an idea. "Let's go somewhere," she said. She stood and strolled to the mortuary van. "Why in the hell are you driving this thing?" she shouted, pulling the passenger door open. She crawled inside and slammed the door behind her. "Fuck," Xander thought. He tossed his cigarette away and walked to the driver's side and climbed in, keeping the keys hidden inside his pocket. He closed the door gently behind him, glancing past her at the door to the gas station. She stared at him with sharp eyes and pointed to the casket. "Is that how you pick up girls?" "I'm on a delivery," he explained. The frosty layer of makeup just moments ago enveloping her face seemed invisible now, melted into her skin. In the indirect blue light of the LED lamp over the pump, she was delicate, her brunette hair rope-like and wavy. It was no wonder the men inside kept tabs. "Let me see," she said. Xander paused. "Will you leave me a couple of cigarettes?" She pulled the pack out of her purse and set four of them on the dashboard. They rolled toward the windshield and stopped in the crevice. He climbed in the back to where the top half of the casket was latched and gestured for her to crawl back there beside him. She was awkward about it, but she was small and they both fit. "There's no makeup yet," he said. "I don't care," she said. "I've seen plenty of dead people." Xander lifted the decorative latch and opened the casket to the height of his forearm. She turned her head sideways to gaze at the boy's face. Her chest rose and fell slowly as she examined him with her quick eyes. "Bet he's in heaven," she said. She looked up at Xander, more tenderly now, and reached for his wrist and pulled his hand to her stomach and slid it down between her legs, squeezing it with her thighs. He tried to pull away, but she squeezed his wrist harder, her eyeballs darting all over his face, her mean little hands grasping his wrist in place. "Feel me," she said. He stopped struggling and let his hand go limp in the space between her panties and her thighs. She took gasps of the stale air, like she had of the cigarette. She put her mouth on his neck and whispered, "Don't forget me," Then she was gone. After another hour on the road, Xander called his mother. She picked up the phone, turned the radio down, and spoke close into the mouthpiece. "This time of year is hard," she said. She was talking about Devin. Unlike other families who remembered their grandmothers, uncles, the birthdays of people who had died organically, Xander's family felt most drawn together over Devin in January, the month when she died. Xander listened to the sounds of his mother's kitchen that echoed through the mouthpiece. "All muscle," she was saying about Devin's legs. She remembered her arms, even more muscular. "Her body was like," she began. Xander switched on the blinker, changed lanes. "A vessel," she said. Xander leaned on the armrest and drove with his left hand. When she was learning to write, his mother said, she held her pencil with four fingers instead of three. In the background, the radio whispered out an easy-listening adult contemporary station, a Sheryl Crow song. "We tried to train her to use three," his mother said, "but she was a liar." She sighed noisily. "You could never hurt me like that." She stopped. "You know?" she asked, her throat tightening. Driving into New Orleans, the interstate highway ebbed and flowed, turned, rose, and fell. A billboard offered in case of an accident to put a man on him. The man it offered had a widow's peak like a vampire. As Xander left the interstate and entered the neighborhood where the funeral home was tucked among houses, he felt that it was always nighttime in this city. He saw it filtered through the bug-splattered window of the mortuary van. The black night was silky behind the colored lights, which were strung across porches and that twirled off the backs of cars and spilled from the doors of bars. On a road lined in these celebratory porches and walk-ups, he arrived at the funeral home's address. It was a house, the numbers illuminated by a light above the doorframe. The street was empty of life, and he left the van running in front of the narrow strip of front yard and knocked on the door. Close up, the house was a deep purple with the texture of paint a thousand layers deep. Flies hovered near the light. A breeze rattled in an oak that towered over the house. A woman opened the door. "Hello," she said, looking content to see him. She was small with a thick web of candied peanut red hair that fell to her hips. Her skin was a rich tan, wrinkled as if the color were from the sun. Her eyes were crystal green, so clear as to appear unreal. Under them were dim half moons. "I'm Sadie." She reached out to shake his hand, and the sleeve of her dress rippled underneath her arm. "Xander," he said. "You can pull all the way down the driveway and park by the fence." He backed up the van and made a wide turn into the narrow drive that split Sadie's house from the one beside it. It dipped, and he parked and put on the emergency brake at the bottom. Sadie brought out a rolling table, and Xander opened the back of the van and climbed inside to slide the casket out. They rolled it from the driveway into a door that led to a small fluorescent preparation room improvised in a garage. There were pallets of makeup on the counter, which stretched around the perimeter. They parked the casket and opened the top half. She looked at the boy carefully, then looked back up to Xander. "Do you have something for me to sign?" He walked to the van and returned with paperwork. In the time it had taken him to go, she had piled her hair on top of her head and brought the room to life with a scented candle. She'd tucked a paper bib into the collar of the boy's shirt and laid paper towels around his head to protect the lining of the casket. He handed her the folder. She set it down and put a hand on her hip. "His mouth needs shutting," she said. "Why don't you fix it?" His lips were slightly parted. He looked bewildered. I know you're not a mortician," Sadie said, "but I'm sure you can." She smiled, challenging him. He didn't say anything, and she opened a shallow drawer and pulled out a pair of rubber gloves, a flashlight, scissors, and floss. She set them on the counter. "I'm out of thread," she said, "but you can use floss. I've done it before." He picked up the gloves, a thick blue pair that fit more snugly than the kind Hughes stocked in bulk. When they were on his hands, he glanced at Sadie, who leaned against the counter and watched him, still smiling. He picked up the flashlight and shined it inside the boy's mouth, and saw the black thread and the thick staple piercing the unbleeding soft palate. The upper staple was loose, sagging on one side. With his left hand, he held the boy's jaw up and parted his lips. With his right, he picked up the scissors and slid them between the teeth to cut the black thread Hughes had strung through the staples, and it fell flat. The boy's jaw sat open and vulnerable while Xander unrolled a foot of floss, cut it, then threaded the end through the bottom and the top staple. He tugged and watched the top staple to be sure it held up. Then he pulled the ends of the string together. "Can you hold his jaw up?" he asked. Sadie walked around the casket, cupped his chin, and pressed it up firmly. Xander pulled the string and pinched it in front of his teeth, pushing his lips out of the way. Then he looped the floss around itself into a knot against the front of his teeth. He picked up the scissors, parted the boy's lips again, and snipped the strings just in front of the knot. His lips fell into place around it. He removed the gloves and looked at Sadie. "Easier than pulling a tooth," she said. She signed the top paper and handed it back to Xander. He folded it into fourths and put it in his pocket. "You should let me give you a reading," she said, "a quick one." "Excuse me," he said. She smiled. "Tarot." He paused. "Sure." Sadie led him into the house. Her living room was shades of mauve and red and pink, each surface draped in some fabric. Floor pillows lined the edges of the room. The center was a pile of beanbags and throw pillars embroidered with gold. He sat against a wall. Sadie brought a tray with a teapot, cups, a tarot deck, a little glass jar of weed and rolling papers. "Mint tea," she said. "Thanks," Xander said. "I like your decorations." "Thank you," she said with a prideful nod. She poured them both tea, then took a rolling paper from the package. "Are you going back to Mississippi tonight?" "Yeah," he said. "I probably shouldn't." She nodded as she spread weed into the paper. "Here," she said, nodding at the cards, "split the deck into thirds." He picked it up and made three stacks. She took her time and he watched as she folded the paper into the line of weed, pinched and rolled it in a tube between her fingers. Sadie smiled with her eyes, looking lovingly down at the joint. She licked it slowly end to end. "Now put the deck back in any order you like," she said. She flicked a lighter and waved the flames side to side to start the burning. She sucked on it and it glowed a circle of bright orange. He watched how she inhaled and made it grow shorter with her strong lungs hidden inside her body, hidden in garments. She saw him watch and passed it to him. He accepted it and inhaled. She spread the deck in a fan across the tray. "Pick one," she said. He reached into the middle and drew a card and handed it to her. She swiped the rest of the deck back into a stack at the side of the tray and set his card face down in the middle. "This card could mean two things," she said. "Number one, it might give you insight about how to respond to your circumstances. Number two, it's where you are going. Sometimes it's both." She placed her hand on the card and paused, then flipped it over. Pictured on the card was a dark sky with a silhouette of a mountain beneath it. Broken wine glasses were scattered in the foreground. The edges of the card were brown from constant use. "What do you see?" she asked. "Broken glasses," he said, "and a mountain." She waited. "You have a change coming. See the sky here?" She placed a finger on it. "It has light. There's a moon behind here." He looked back down at the card. Behind the mountain, the sky was a shade lighter. "It's a good thing. You just keep going." She smoked and he looked around the room, at the paintings on the walls, then back down at the card. "You do not think you're very lucky," she said, exhaling and smiling at him. "I guess not," he said. "How old are you?" 18. "You have a lot of responsibility," she said, adjusting on her pillow, cat-like, "with the job." Xander shrugged. He felt his face beginning to flush. "Guess what I used to do for a living," she said. "Something with makeup," Xander tried. She shook her head. A pilot? She laughed, abrupt and youthful. Is it something you have to go to school for? She nodded, her gaze expectant, a mermaid in her grotto. Lawyer, he said. Voila, she exclaimed. She threw her head back and smiled up at the ceiling, wiggling a bit to find a comfortable position on the too soft pillow. Now the funeral home pays me in cash, so I'm free, like you. She smoked and tried to offer him the waning joint, but he declined. That was a good guess, she said finally, sighing. She looked at him. He was trying to think of a way to say that he should go. Thank you for the hospitality, he said. Ah, this is just love, not some southern hospitality. She set the joint down and slipped his tarot card back into the deck. They both stood and Xander stretched. She led him back to the garage, where she stopped beside the boy and placed her hand on his arm. She turned to Xander. You know the superstition about when you mess up a prep? No, he said. You have to leave something with the body. She looked at his puzzled expression. A talisman. Xander felt in his pocket and pulled out the rabbit's foot. Very good, she said. He tucked the totem inside the boy's blazer, awkwardly. Goodbye, he thought. She stood at the door. This was nice, he said, and immediately regretted it. Thank you, she said. She was still with her hand on the doorknob. He walked toward her, and she opened the door. If he was going to try something, this would be the moment where he would touch her face, where the stray hair fell beside her jawbone, and he would kiss her, a woman, the first woman but third girl whose face he'd touched, there where she painted dead bodies. He opened his arms wide, smiled, and they embraced. Thanks for the reading, he said, loud beside her ear. He let her go, and she pulled away. See you next time. He left, and she watched him until he was in the van and the lights were on. Xander looked up at the sky and saw something shoot across it, then fly back in the other direction, a bug. He backed out of the driveway slowly, blinking, and retraced his turns from the interstate. Along the quiet streets, he seemed to see hands and faces reflecting from every surface. As the hood of the car moved under the streetlights, his eyes followed the light that trailed off the left edge of the hood of the car like a frantic hand spinning gold. The shadow of the rearview mirror hit the passenger seat and moved as the car moved. At a stoplight, he saw a face in his peripheral vision, but when he turned, it was window drapes. As the van approached the interstate ramp, Xander spotted a sign for a park. Behind the sign, a vacant lot overlooked a canal. Yellow street lamps invited him to stop. He turned toward the sign and drove until he reached a place where the entrance was blocked with a rusted chain wrapped around a gate, and he got out of the van and moved it. He pulled the van inside and slept in the driver's seat until 3 a.m., when a barge passed through the canal and his consciousness lifted. Xander dreamed of when he started going to school with his sister, who was years ahead of him. He was afraid, and she was nervous herself because it was her first day of the new year, too. When they got out of the car, he told her how he felt, and she held his hand and walked him to the kindergarten. That was when he woke up in the foyer of the kindergarten, in New Orleans in the mortuary van, with the sky and a couple of stars, a barge moving silently below it, and in between the two, a layer of sky tinged yellow-pink by the lighted world below. Thank you guys for being here.